Good afternoon. May it please the court. Barry Girk, on behalf of the plaintiff below, Megan Burns and her 11-year-old daughter, Kylie Burns. Before the court today for review is the decision of the Superior Court granting summary judgment to defendant on the grounds that the premises guest statute, 25 Delaware Code, section 1501, barred the plaintiff's action for personal injuries caused by the defendant's negligence. The facts are fairly straightforward.
Well, if the facts are straightforward, can you identify any genuine issue of material fact, or are we just examining the application of the law?
Well, as I pointed out in Section 3 of the brief, Your Honor, yes, I think there are questions of fact to be resolved by the finder of fact.
Can we start with that?
We can
What are the critical ones, the one that would make a difference in the case, if they were resolved in favor of the plaintiff's inferences?
Well, I think that the citations to the two status cases, licensee versus public invitee and trespasser versus public invitee, and in the Kane versus Newcastle County case, the court found that there were sufficient disputes of fact as to whether the area was closed, whether there was appropriate barricading or signage, or whether under comment C to the restatement that defines public invitee status, that a reasonable man would have determined that it was okay to be in that area, that there was implied.
Well, what confused me in reading the briefs is whether you agree that this definitely occurred on the defendant's property. Are we assuming that the accident occurred on the defendant's property?
We are assuming that.
So we don't have to worry about whether it was partially in the right-of-way, completely in the right-of-way. The whole discussion in the briefs about whether the van was over the line but the people weren't over the line, we're still talking about the accident being on the private property of the defendant.
I should clarify that there's two issues that we're talking about here. The first is where the negligence occurred,
right,
where the impact occurred. The lady backed into my client's van. And I think what I meant, Your Honor, was we are assuming that that occurred on the defendant's premises.
Okay.
The other point is where those premises ended, the boundary line ended, it's possible that the plaintiffs were actually outside of those premises and in the street right-of-way. And that would have significance under the Higgins case, which is a Superior Court case where premises guest statute was raised as a defense, where there was a hunter fired a shot on private land but hit a person who was off property.
Well, that's the reason I asked that at the beginning of the argument, as the Chief Justice said about disputes of fact, is it your position that the premises guest statute applies across the board to everything at issue in this case, and we're simply looking at status? Or are you suggesting that we need to find out exactly where the injury occurred, where the accident occurred? That's all in dispute, and because of that, summary judgment was inappropriate, and it's only after we have engineers or surveyors or accident reconstruction people that tell us whether the premises guest statute applies or not that we then go to status.
I would say, Your Honor, that we are contending under the facts viewed most favorably to the plaintiff that we have public invitee status. But then, as the third argument, if the court decides that we can't do that, and that's really part of the question of fact to be resolved by the jury, then we have this question of where they were in reference to the boundary property of the residential land.
We would do it in the opposite order, because if we do it in the order you just stated, we're going to wind up giving an advisory opinion if it turns out there's a dispute of fact with regard to whether the guest premises statute applies at all. So we first have to identify the premises that are in issue before we start applying the guest premises statute or saying it doesn't apply.
I understand. Yes, that would be right. It would address the question of where the plaintiffs were physically in their van relative to the boundary line of the defendant's property.
Well, help me. There's a driveway that meets up with the road. Where was the minor plaintiff? Was she over top of the driveway when the accident occurred, or was she out on the paved area of the street?
I think as the facts are developed thus far, that's not known. The testimony at the arbitration hearing, which forms the basis of our appendix, was that the plaintiff was partially in the driveway, not the full length of the van, and that she had merely nosed her vehicle in, which to me implies something less than even half.
But would the premises guest statute even apply if the minor plaintiff never entered onto property occupied by Ms. Doan?
That's right. That's the Higgins case.
Now you concede, though, that the driveway all the way to the street line was occupied by Ms. Doan for residential purposes and fits literally within the text of the premises guest statute.
My recollection of the photographs indicates that. There wasn't a sidewalk here.
But you agree that the occupied lands go all the way to the actual paved road?
Oh, I see. No, there was no survey done in this case. So we don't know. We don't know exactly where that boundary line is.
But wouldn't the owner of the property occupy the driveway all the way to the street line? In other words, wouldn't the premises guest statute apply even if the land were actually, the fee were held by the state? But it's not only ownership, but it's also occupying, and doesn't one occupy the land simply by having a driveway over it?
Well, I think the situation is unclear simply because there's no driveway, and there may be an area that doesn't have grass. So the lawn came out to a certain point. There may have been some dirt or not pavement, but not grass. And then the driveway was gravel, as I recall, and my recollection is that did come out to the paved area.
Well, there's no question the point of impact was on the driveway.
We've assumed that. On the driveway, absolutely.
And the only issue here is whether the occupant of the back seat of the vehicle was on the driveway, on an easement owned by the state, or in the main travel portion of the roadway?
I would submit, Your Honor, that it would be both plaintiffs. You have to decide where the property line is relative to both plaintiffs being positioned in the van.
You're not suggesting that there's a possibility here that the guest premises guest statute would apply to one but not the other because of how they were positioned in the vehicle, who impacted on the landowner's property.
I suppose that's theoretically possible. If, for example, the impact occurs 2-3 feet inside the boundary line for this rented property that the defendant occupied, and the front seat passenger was 2 feet back from the front, then she would be on the premises and it would apply, but the daughter who was in the back seat would not if the back seat were, say, 5 feet back.
All right, well, why would we decide anything as a matter of law then before these facts were resolved, they are indeed relevant?
I understand that's what the court would, how the court would proceed.
So it boils down to, at least on one significant legal argument as you see it, the fact finder was improperly denied the opportunity to resolve this material issue, which is genuinely in dispute, and therefore we should remand it to have that resolved before we rule on anything as a matter of law. Is that your position?
Yes. I think that the court, as a matter of judicial economy, could make rulings that would guide the lower court.
As a matter of judicial economy, how serious were the injuries in this case?
They were soft tissue spinal injuries, Your Honor.
Okay.
Does the court want me to address the status?
Yes, because we're just asking questions. I don't think – I know my mind's not made up about what to do, so you should.
Certainly. The first argument that we have asserted – has to do with the public policy behind the mandatory motor vehicle financial responsibility laws, in the sense that these are designed to protect innocent people who have been injured through the negligence of drivers. There is a universal coverage that's required. And on the other hand, we have the premises guest statute, which is designed to insulate landowners or occupiers from the consequences of their own negligence. The defendant has cast this as judicial legislation and says that the plaintiffs are trying to carve out an exception to the premises guest statute. The plaintiffs look at it and say that the defendant is the one who's trying to carve out an exception to this well-established public policy that runs through many, many cases from this court that says that there is superseding, that the policy supersedes contract provisions in the auto policy, and it also supersedes the immunity doctrines that might be found at common law.
But would it supersede statute?
Well, that's the point that the defendant makes, but I think that the defendant does not consider that the public policy comes from the legislative intent from the statute, the motor vehicle financial responsibility laws themselves. So you have two competing legislative intents.
Well, you're arguing legislative policy out of the automobile realm versus express statutory language in the premises guest statute. Why wouldn't the express legislative language in Section 1501 tell us what to do?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. Under statutory general rules of statutory construction, the more specific statute will govern over the general statute. If we look and compare, the premises guest statute is general, talks about all kinds of torts, and applies in a general way to accidents, injuries that occur on occupier's property. If we look at the motor vehicle laws, they're very specific. They identify any number of considerations that are to be taken into account when people are getting their insurance, sets the limits, minimum limits, et cetera. That would be one construction rule that we could apply. Another would be later in time supersedes earlier in time. Premises guest statute was last amended in 1980. The 21 Delaware Code, Section 2118, which is one of the two mandatory financial responsibility laws, was last amended, in fact, last year, 2007. And the other one, Section 2902, was last amended, I believe, in 1995, both of which were amended after the last premises guest statute was amended. And what that means is, again, under general rules of statutory construction, the later statutes are republished, and the presumption is that the General Assembly knew of existing statutory provisions and also was aware of the decisions of this court where the superseding, overriding public policy is identified with clarity. That would be one way to look at it. And that would lead to the conclusion that the policy and the legislative intent of the mandatory financial responsibility laws in this case carry a more important social function than protecting a landowning tortfeasor from the consequences of her own negligence.
Can we get back to the initial discussion about facts for a moment? Am I misunderstanding the trial court's decision, because I believe the trial court said, I don't really care whether the car was on a portion of the driveway where it might technically be still an easement or a right-of-way or anything like that, that it all has to do with the fact that this was their driveway. And because it was their driveway, and I've concluded that they did not invite people to use their driveway, the premises guest statute is applicable. So didn't the trial court say that it doesn't matter what the facts are?
I think that's right, because we did argue to the trial court, Your Honor, that there were issues of fact that needed to be resolved by a finder of fact. And the court said, no, we have enough to proceed to enter summary judgment.
And do you have any argument with the trial court's premise that it doesn't matter what the technical legal status of the driveway was at various points in proximity to the road? Once you're on the driveway, the premises guest statute applies, and we don't have to be concerned with who owns the land at that point.
No, I would agree with Your Honor that issue certainly has to be addressed. And what I did by ordering my arguments was fall into a misunderstanding that the facts would be critical, and that the court would not issue an opinion on the status as the Superior Court did when there were lingering issues to be resolved.
Well, I'm not sure that you answered Justice Berger's question. As I understand it, the plaintiff says my vehicle was only partially
on the occupied driveway. And the defendant says the vehicle was entirely on the driveway.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's the contention.
So your position has to be that the trial judge got it wrong when he concluded for himself, as a matter of fact, that both vehicles were entirely on an occupied portion of the driveway. There's no issue about whether DelDOT or a town had an easement and partially paved the driveway or didn't. There's a dispute of fact about whether the vehicle that was struck was entirely on an occupied driveway or only partially on an occupied driveway, and then an even more interesting, I'll put it that way, argument that it's possible that a person within the vehicle was on the occupied driveway, but another person injured was not on the occupied driveway. That's the problem, and I think what Justice Berger was asking, if I could be so bold to recharacterize it, because I didn't really get your answer, is there or is there not a dispute of fact about that? And is that dispute of fact material?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it is. There is a dispute of fact, and it is material. But if I recall Judge Witham's decision, he, I think, assumed that what the plaintiff said partially out of the driveway was the fact, because he has to view the facts in a light most favorable to a non-moving party. But then I think maybe the and I'd have to go right back and parse through the decision again, but that since the impact occurred on the defendant's driveway, that it was imputed or imparted through the vehicle, and it was immaterial where the actual injury occurred.
Okay, so he focused on point of impact on occupied driveway. That's all I need to know.
I think so.
In order to conclude that the guest statute applies.
I think so. I think that's what he did.
And you don't dispute that the point of impact was on the occupied property, right?
Right.
Oh, okay.
It hasn't been determined, but for purposes of the summary judgment and for purposes of this appeal, that has been the assumption that both sides have made in their briefs.
Well, when you say it hasn't been determined, both sides have determined that that's the fact, right? So it's not in dispute. So well, wouldn't anything for the jury to determine about that?
Well, I guess the way I should say it, Your Honor, is that there was no survey done, and there was no testimony. Neither the defendant nor the plaintiff knew where the boundary line was to articulate it at the hearing.
Didn't your complaint allege that the point of impact was on the occupied driveway?
I think we had an allegation in there that nosed into the defendant's driveway, something like that.
And then the premises guest statute was raised as a defense?
Correct, Your Honor.
In response to the allegations in your complaint?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's why you develop a factual argument that, oh, but, by the way, there might have been an injured person or more in the vehicle that was nosed onto the driveway and impacted on the occupied driveway, whose body was physically not on the driveway, and you draw the analogy to the shooting case.
Yes, John.
So you think it's not significant where the point of impact occurred. You think it's significant where the party was that was injured as a result of the impact. Is that the fact?
Well, as to my knowledge, this court has not resolved that particular issue. It was in the Higgins case, and that was a Superior Court decision.
Do you have a good faith basis, any basis, to contend that the point of impact was not on the occupied driveway?
Only because, Your Honor, there wasn't a survey done. There wasn't a bright line that said, this is the boundary over here, is the driveway, and this remains the unused right of way. So
this all started because of the allegation in your complaint that referenced the driveway. And then the defense was raised in response to your allegation referencing the driveway. Then the court, Superior Court, went forward with the assumption that the point of impact was on the occupied driveway. Did anybody tell the Superior Court, you can't decide this as a matter of law because there's a material dispute of fact about whether the point of impact was, in fact, on the occupied driveway?
I'm sure I did at some point, Your Honor, whether it was in the written submissions or an oral argument. But one of the things that we have to draw a distinction for is we have said in our complaint the driveway, but we didn't say on the defendant's property. And I think maybe it's a semantic difference that could be important. The gravel did extend out, and so we really don't dispute that there was on the gravel part of the driveway. We just don't know whether that was simply an extension off of her boundaries.
So perhaps we should ask the defendant's lawyer, because since it was raised as a defense, maybe it's incumbent upon them to say, if your defense is that the premises guest statute applies, you need to come forward and establish the accident occurred on the premises.
That's true, Your Honor. Yes, it would be the burden to prove their affirmative defense. I see that my light is on. I'm sorry?
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Chancellor. Brian McNellis, I'm here on behalf of Ms. Doan. She is the appellee in this case. I want to start out by addressing the very issue that's been the topic of most of the conversation this afternoon, and that is the allegation that there are factual issues involved in this. I don't think the factual history that we have here is as unclear as is being portrayed to the court. We've heard testimony from both the plaintiffs. We've heard testimony from the defendant. We have submitted as an exhibit in our briefs the police report. All indicate that the impact took place within my client's driveway. I think there may be a factual dispute as to whether it took place within an easement or not. Obviously, our position is that that is not relevant to the court's determination. We don't think there's any legal significance to whether or not it is in an easement or not. But from a factual standpoint as to the impact, we don't think that there is a good faith argument, as Justice Holland pointed out, that the impact took place anyplace else other than within the occupied driveway of my client.
What does the record tell us in terms of undisputed fact as to where the passengers in the plaintiff's car were vis-a-vis the driveway? In other words, if just the front wheels were on the driveway, the impact is on the driveway, but the passengers or the plaintiffs had not entered your client's occupied lands.
Well, the only testimony that was received on that, and we did not reference that in our briefs, and I don't think the plaintiff did either, was that there was observation by both of the plaintiffs directly forward through the windshield, saw my client stopped. That's the facts in the light most favorable to the appellant here. That includes the minor occupant in the back looking straight through. The testimony we heard from the plaintiff was that she had turned into the driveway, right? She uses the word nosed in, but her van was lined up parallel with the driveway. At that point, she had looked in her rearview mirror, observed that behind her there was an area across the street that vehicles were using to turn around. At that point, her intention was to use that area like the other vehicles were, thus our argument regarding the necessity. But based upon that piece of evidence, the only evidence we have, it would appear that that van was lined up in the driveway. And again, based on the testimony we have from both the occupants of that van and my client and the police report, the impact was within our driveway, which would, in our position, mean that 15-2501 absolutely applies. That is exactly the kind of scenario that the legislature intended to protect my client from.
Well, at least as the facts have been summarized for me for this argument, the plaintiff contends that she pulled her minivan partially into your client's driveway, while your client says she was checking the flow of traffic and claims that the plaintiff pulled her minivan a full car length into the occupied driveway. Now, does it make any difference? What is, for the purpose of the application of the premises guest statute, the point of impact, or is it important where the person was who was injured as a result of the impact? Does it make any difference?
Our position, Your Honor, would be it would make no difference. There is no facts, no good faith argument to be made here based on the factual record we have from all three of these folks under oath that the impact took place any place other than the driveway. I would reference, Your Honor, to the Restatement of Torts 158. It's a code, or it's a section interpreting the application, and it states the meaning of enters land. That is the language that is used in 2501, and it states, unless otherwise indicated, the phrase enters land is for convenience used throughout the restatement of this subject to include not only coming upon land, but also remaining on it, and in addition to include the presence upon the land of a third person or a thing which the actor has caused to be or remain there. Our position is pushing the van onto the property, having that impact take place on the property, qualifies as enters, as intended by the legislature in 2501, according to the restatement section. If we also take a look at the criminal statute.
Well, before you go any further, I just want to nail this down if I can. From your perspective, if the facts were established, and we can assume the facts to be that this minivan didn't even get more than the front wheels onto the driveway. The whole rest of the minivan was perpendicular to the street, but not yet on your client's driveway when the accident took place. That we can make that assumption for purposes of our analysis, because your position is that as long as the point of impact occurred on the premises, on the driveway, it doesn't matter whether the entire vehicle was on the driveway or not, and it doesn't matter whether the occupants who were injured were physically on the property or still out on the street.
That would be our position, Your Honor, based upon the restatement section, based upon the facts that we've got. This is what differentiates this case from the gunshot case that we had, where the innocent man is driving along and the bullet comes from on property, off of property. In that instance, there was no twist of the facts that placed him in any way entering the property that was relevant. In this instance, under the facts that Your Honor had just portrayed, there is an entry, even if it is only a portion of the front of that van. There is entry, which would trigger the very terms of 2501. Under the legislative intent, under the language of that statute, based on the interpretation of the restatement of torts. And I will also point out the criminal trespass statute, that is 11-829, states a person enters.
Okay, wait. Before, again, I just want to finish this up. If we disagree that you're making the argument that as a matter of law, it doesn't matter whether the car was on the driveway only 1 foot of the car or all 9 feet or 10 feet of the car. It doesn't matter because as long as the accident took place and on the property and the car was entering the property, that's it. So if we disagree with your underlying premise, then we have a dispute of fact, correct?
That may be a dispute of fact, Your Honor. However, our position on in citing the law would be that would mean that the alleged negligent act by my client is within her driveway, and that the actions by the plaintiff would comply with the very language of 2501 that states my client's protected if you enter onto property that my client occupies.
But isn't your client protected only with respect to those injuries sustained by the plaintiff while on the premises? In other words, the statute has a two-pronged test. You've got to enter the premises, and then it's injury sustained while on the premises.
But under the,
I'm just reading 1501.
There is certainly an exception for intentional, willful, and wanton damage sustained by the person while on the premises.
So in other words, if they're not physically over top the driveway, they're not on your client's premises, are they?
Well, I think we would go back earlier in that very language of the statute and say, what does it mean to have entered onto the premises? No person who enters would take us back and are looking at the law to that meaning of entry under the restatement that says putting that van in there qualifies as entry on the property. The legislative intent would provide protection.
So we should just ignore the words while on the premises?
Well, I think that they have to be interpreted in light of the no one who enters into private, residential, or farm premises. Our position would be that entry is defined by the restatement, which talks about taking an object and putting it on to the property. Moving on to the argument that was made about the financial responsibility statute. As we have argued in our brief, it is our position that the court's being asked here to counterweigh two public policies, one that goes along with the financial responsibility statute, the other, and it's being given short shift by the plaintiff, a very strong legislative public policy, the intent of the legislature to protect occupiers of property from allegations of mere negligence by someone who enters. I can think of perhaps no greater definition of what is the job of the legislature than weighing two potentially competing public policies and deciding which of those should be primary.
But your client has insurance that would cover these damages, right?
There would be insurance if the accident took place off the property and within the street, yes, Your Honor. But the financial responsibility statute ensures that there's insurance on the car. What you're being asked by the plaintiff to do is to actually create a cause of action from whole cloth where none exists at this point. The financial responsibility statute certainly has been used repeatedly to obviate policy language that would create an exception to coverage, whether you're...
Well, but wait a second. Two cars got in an accident here, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And there was insurance covering the car, right?
Yes, ma'am.
So if the premises guest statute didn't bar this action, are you saying there's anything in the insurance policy that would bar coverage?
Oh, no, ma'am. No. In fact, our position is that premises guest is applicable before there's even a consideration of whether there's insurance. There's insurance on the vehicle. My client had insurance on the car. Thus, the applicability or non-applicability of the financial responsibility statute ends there. We're looking at this from whether there's a cause of action to be had from the people in the van against my lady backing out of her driveway. And a review of the Delaware case law has indicated that financial responsibility statute has indeed carved off exceptions to policy language, even overcome common law policy. But in no instance has it either overcome a statute with articulated legislative intent, nor has it created a whole cause of action where none existed before. Our position is that...
Well, the cause of action is negligence, isn't it?
The cause of action is negligence against a property owner upon their land for just mere negligence. As
for negligence in operating a motor vehicle.
That is correct, Your Honor.
There's a cause of action. I think we're splitting hairs, but there's a cause of action. There always has been. The legislature's created a defense to it.
Well, what we're being asked to do is to create an exception to that. And the court in the past has expressed profound reluctance to do that very thing. In fact, in the case history regarding the corollary to the statute, and that is the automobile guest statute, the court articulated on several occasions that they were unwilling to carve off a patchwork exception to this. This issue, if it was alleged to be evil or unfair, as is being alleged here, and as was to the automobile guest statute, the proper venue, the proper forum to have those alleged inequities addressed is over with the legislature.
Well, how would you summarize the exception that you see being requested here?
The exception would be if a vehicle is involved, then there will be a cause of action under negligence from a trespasser or a guest without payment against the landowner. And I think that, Your Honor, would be a very slippery slope. I think that we would have in that instance, if that were the ruling of the court, the potential to have any negligent action taking place on a property attempt to be tied in some way to a motor vehicle, whether you're walking to it or whether you got your...
Well, what's your understanding of the law now? Let's suppose someone had a long lane to their house. It's clearly private property. And you have the owner exiting and a guest entering, and they have a collision on the lane. Does everyone's automobile insurance respond?
Under that scenario, and I want to make sure I'm distressing it the way you wish to, Your Honor, if there's no factual dispute as to it being on that long lane, our position would be that that is within the actual square black-letter law of 152501, that would be an allegation of mere negligence against a guest without payment, against the occupier of the property. There would be no cause of action on that. In fact, the statute addresses not only residential pieces of property, but also farmland as well, which would perhaps even be a better example of where there might be a long lane. Given that the legislature included farmland where there's the potential for those long lanes, I think that legislative intent has to be made to cover that scenario that Your Honor has just spun. A long street, a motor vehicle accident that had taken place out on State Street here would absolutely be a cause of action and insurance coverage. But on a private lane would not be a cause of action. There'd be immunity from that under the terms of the statute.
But our position is there wouldn't be a cause of action if the claim were negligence, but there would be a cause of action if the claim were willful or wanton conduct.
Right? If the claim were willful or wanton, Your Honor, if there was an allegation that the person was a business invitee, there are those carved off exceptions. But Your Honor is correct. If there's willful or wanton, I do want to point out to the court that at no time is there any facts associated with this case that willful or wanton or business invitee status is even remotely on the table. Those don't apply in this instance. There was also a claim made, Your Honors, that this was that the statute shouldn't apply out of necessity, that essentially with a tree being down in the road, that there was an obligation to allow their driveway to be open because ingress, egress was blocked along that roadway. As I pointed out a moment ago, the undisputed facts are that there was no necessity involved in this case. If we look at those very aged cases that were cited by the plaintiff, all of them have as a primary element the necessity of you can't get through, you have to use this adjacent piece of private property to continue your travels. That isn't the case in this instance.
Well, when you say it's an undisputed fact that there's no necessity, it's certainly not a conceded fact, because Mr. Kirk makes the opposite argument. Are you really saying that there's no evidence from which an inference of necessity can be drawn?
I did not word it well, Your Honor. You did it much better than I, and that would be yes. Immediately behind the plaintiff was a place that was being used by the traffic to turn around. And the record is from her own testimony. She intended to use that to make the turnaround and go back the other direction. So there's no necessity to use my client's driveway. There was also an allegation that somehow lack of signage turns this from a piece of private property into a public invitee. I think that is a misinterpretation of the Kane case put down by this court. In that case, we had a public piece of property, park upstate in Newcastle County, where a portion was clearly open to the public. There was actions taken by the county to invite children, families to go out there onto this park and employ it. There was a whole separate section of the park where construction was taking place. It was on that piece that a child was injured while sledding. And the county attempted, this was before the statute had changed and was only now applicable to farmland and residents, the county attempted to employ 2501 as immunity against this allegation of negligence. And the court ruled that there was no differentiation between the open portion of the property that the county had held open and the closed portion where the construction had taken place. Counsel attempts to take that application and move it from a dividing line within the property to the edge of the property. It is established law under the restatement that a person coming onto the property only becomes a public invitee if there is some affirmative action by the landowner to essentially entice them on, a manifestation of the invitation. What we're hearing from the other side is that lack of signage, lack of a chain, lack of express desire to not have you there becomes, by definition, an invitation that I'm enticing you to come onto the property. There is no facts in this case that would evidence my client's enticement to have the public at large onto their property. And I think it is a dangerous precedent to for the court to decide that lack of signage, lack of a barrier, lack of some kind of affirmative action to keep people out becomes, by definition, an invitation to have them come in and would represent an exception to the premises guest statute. There was quite a bit of argument regarding an easement in plaintiff's briefs. At this point, Your Honor, there has been no arguments proffered that even the presence of an easement would change the status and represent an exception to 2501. We're willing to concede at this point that there may be a factual dispute as to whether or not the impact the van was on an easement or not. Actually, our position would be that it would be plaintiff's burden to show that easement existed, and the affidavit that was provided, I believe, is inadequate in that regard. That affidavit talks of broad generalities of where easements normally are, how they could be associated with poles. No survey was ever done in this case to say that there was an easement, how wide it was, or that this impact took place within it. But even if there was an easement, there is no Delaware case law that indicates that an easement in of itself represents an exception to 2501. In fact, under the Acton case, the court decided...
What if the easement was one that allowed the public generally to traverse the property? I mean, it makes a difference, of course, does it not, if the easement is limited to utility companies, to put up or repair utilities on the one hand, and on the other hand, an easement that would basically open up access to the property to the entire public.
Well, I can certainly envision an easement that would perhaps allow the public to go on. But again, I don't think an easement in of itself represents an exception to the statute. At one point in the Acton case, a claim was made to try and get immunity under 2501, and a counter was made that the railroad in that case only had an easement.
Well, if there's an easement that creates access to the public, then isn't it correct that by definition any member of the public who would walk on that portion of the driveway that's an easement is not a trespasser?
If the easement were structured to allow the public access, for example, to the other side of the property, I can envision a situation where that may be indeed true. We have no evidence that that type of easement exists here or what even the nature of that easement would be. The court has ruled, though, that an occupier, a holder of an easement, in the Acton case, a railroad, qualified as an occupier for triggering of 2501 immunity.
Well, I think Justice Jacobs is addressing an easement that the landowner agrees amounts to saying the general public are invitees and then voluntarily by contract takes that portion of the property out of the protection of the guest statute. But it would be a huge surprise, I think, to most of us to think that any ordinary residential landowner would enter into that kind of easement with anyone for any reason. And there's no facts in this case that support it.
There's actually no facts in this case, Your Honor, to support
it. But there can be an easement potentially that would change the status of the people that came onto the property from guests without payment and trespassers to business invitees just by the wording of the easement that you agreed to.
I can certainly envision that type of an easement, and if that scenario were in play, I would imagine that that would translate someone coming on and employing that easement for the purpose in which it was held open from a trespasser into a public invitee. But in this instance, I don't believe we have any facts from which that reasonable inference can be derived.
Do you have anything else?
I have none, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Mr. Kirk, you have 4 minutes and 23 seconds left for rebuttal.
To follow up on the line of questioning that had to do with the questions of fact that have remained to be resolved by the finder of fact, it sharpened the focus of the fact that this is an affirmative defense, and the burden of proof on the affirmative defense lies on the defendant. And all the elements that are set forth in Section 1501 must be proved by the defendant in order to invoke protection of that statute. As Vice Chancellor Noble pointed out, there is distinct language in 1501 that not just says who enters onto the private residential or farm purposes, but it also says for injuries or damages sustained by such person while on the premises.
Yeah. You'd have us accept that someone in a car that enters onto your property maybe hasn't entered onto your property because their body position in the car may still be off your property. That's what we'd have to accept in order to call that a genuine issue of material fact, wouldn't we?
I think that's right. You would have to, well, before you can get to the legal decision, is where the negligence is, where the impact occurred, different from where the injury occurs.
It's almost like making the argument that the passenger didn't enter because they weren't driving the car. It was the driver that entered and the car that entered. Does that make any sense in the real world?
Well, we're looking at the statute. And the
I'll concede the statute's part of the real world. You got me on that, Mr. Burke.
I think that the injury has to be sustained while on the premises. And it may be absurd, splitting hairs, but I think that if you read that statute language literally, that's what was the basis for the Higgins decision.
But under that reading of the statute, you could have a situation where the driver would be barred from recovery in the front seat and the passenger in the back seat would recover in the same accident in the same car.
Under that reading of the literal language, yes, sir.
Is there any authority either way on that particular point? I mean, is this an issue that's been covered in the briefs?
There's no authority that I could find, Your Honor, that where there's a partial, where the court decided the impact and the negligence was imputed over a geographic distance to people who were off the property. The only case that I could find is that Higgins case with the shooting. Mr. McNellis mentioned argued that there was no necessity to go counter to the plaintiff's argument of invitation by necessity, making the plaintiff's public invitees.
He's saying, actually, that there's nothing that your side put into the record that would have created a genuine inference of necessity to support your argument.
Well, the plaintiff testified that the road was blocked and was impassable.
And yes. But the response is that there may be a necessity to turn around, but no evidence that it was necessary to turn into this defendant's driveway as opposed to someplace, some other way, in order to turn the car around.
That's correct, and it didn't make any sense to me when it was in the briefs, because if you look at these older cases, a tree blocks a road, and there's private property on one side of the road, and there's private property on the other side of the road. You put the person whose thoroughfare is blocked in Hobson's choice. Do I go this way and then face the argument there's no necessity? You could have gone on the other private property owner's lane or on the other side.
Well, you put them on these facts into Hobson's choice of choosing a driveway with a vehicle already in it and one without one, I guess. I mean, what is necessity under those circumstances?
Well, the cases don't require that. It's an implied invitation.
The cases don't require that, but you only talk about two cases.
Well, I believe we mentioned four, Your Honor.
Four.
From the through early 1900s, starting with this case in 1851, that engrafted the rulings from the English common law.
On that theory, it'd been safer just to pull into the front yard, because it's unlikely any other car is going to confront you in the front yard in your operation of the rule of necessity.
Well, it might have been safer, but the implied invitation is to the driveway, to use the driveway.
Thank you, Mr. Gregg. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for a very interesting
and
argument. We'll recess and take the case under advisement.